Dash number 17754, Benny Gordon, reel 3.
Benny Gordon, reel 3. So the unit you went in with, was that the 254th Tank Battalion?
No, the 498th Foot Battalion.
The 4?
498th Foot Battalion.
Port Battalion.
Yeah.
That was the one you were with in England?
Yes.
Right. And which beach did you land on?
Omaha.
And were you there on D-Day itself, or were you after D-Day?
D-Day plus, I think, 2 or 3.
So what was that like, Benny? How did you feel when you were on that amphibious craft going in towards that beach?
I was afraid. The unknown is what brings us fear. Fear of the unknown. And yet I thought about those immortal words of President Roosevelt when he said, "You have nothing to fear but fear itself." And yet they sounded good, but when you try to analyze it, you've got to understand fear. And when you understand fear, you're back at fear. But it sounds good.
What was the sight as you came in? What did you see?
Water as far as you could see. And you're in this amphibious duck, and you see arms, legs on the water. You see a field equipment on the water where someone's lost, maybe got shot, or you don't know, but these are things that you see going in. Then after we got on the beach, we were supposed to run with in position, and you had your full field pack on your back and your gun in your hand, and you would see people picking up a beautiful gold watch or gold or whatever and being blown apart and all that kind of thing just by having picked up the watch. So you learn right quick. I don't care how beautiful it is. You never know whether that's a mine or not. So even though they had... it was supposed to have had somebody in there to make a clearance for mines, but I don't care unless you know where they are, and they can be in some of the most inconspicuous places. So those are some of the things that you encountered. We took over a convent there in France. And we stayed in this convent. That was, I guess they said if they stay in the convent, they ain't going to bomb the convent. And we found, what we found in that convent, and it shows you how things go. We found humans in that had been preserved in jars in the convent. That was a part of exploratory in the convent. There again, we had people that we had never met before, and you still had a class system there. Even the poorest of the poor, as long as he was white, he was supposed to be superior to us. So that was, and they believed that until after. See, education is so powerful. When you can give people propaganda for so long, pretty soon their eyes are going to be open. They're going to be educated, and they can think for themselves. And that is one of the most powerful tools that we have. That's power, when you can think. When you have knowledge, it's power.
Did you find, though, that the French were more or less racist than, say, what you found in Britain? How did you find
I found
experience?
That my personal opinion is that the French will go whichever way the money goes. That's the way they go. They would go along with the American white man and get what he has to offer and stab him in the back every time.
How did they regard you, though? How did you...
Generally, they regarded the black soldier as their man. And in a lot of instances, you had people that couldn't speak very well the same language. And if they were caught out together, the first thing that is the case is rape, just by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's rape. And they took advantage of the situation because of breakdown in communication. And you had a lot of innocent people, men, go to prison because of that.
What, Afro-Americans, you mean? Yes, what sort of, what were they accused of then?
Rape. See, the young lady was not able to speak the language, and here you got an interpreter, and here's a Afro-American soldier who couldn't speak French very well, so it's a railroad type of situation. And something. Of course, I understand that a lot of the cases were overturned here after review, being reviewed in the United States, were overturned. Now, I understand that, but I don't know that. I found that of all the countries, you'll find that England was very loyal. England is our mother country. And is very loyal to America. And right, wrong, or indifferent, they usually side with America. See? Now, in some instances, we've had some, I don't know who it was now, that could stand up against, well, Churchill could stand up against him. He would tell it like it is. And he had that respect. But I don't find too many others that will really. You know, we can differ without falling out. And America feels that to differ is to fall out.
Right. But let's go back to the war, Benny. And here you were in France. Were you involved in any action at this early stage?
Yeah, the Battle of the Bulge. That's a famous letter. Communication that was sent down to headquarters to be read at the first gathering of all black troops or Negro troops. Your country needs you more than ever. You have an opportunity to serve with your brothers in arms, et cetera, et cetera. And then that's when we volunteered for frontline duty, 254th Tank Battalion.
And were you in that?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
So you gave up your admin work, did
yes,
you,
mm-hmm.
to actually take up arms, Benny? Yes, what was your experience?
Well, really, when I volunteered there, I took my MOS with me. They needed administration, too. So I went, I didn't have, we just moved, our headquarters moved closer in to every time Patton would move 100 miles, we'd move 50 miles closer. Closer in.
And you were still engaged in your admin work,
yes,
were you?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But did you get an impression of the contribution made by the Afro-American troops in the fighting.
Oh, yes, yes. See, that 254th Tank Battalion invented what I call the bank basket concept. They would take their guns, a machine gun, tanks, and run through a town mowing it down. And they had no regard for American interests because they took the opinion that they can build more interests, but they cannot build another man. So they wouldn't take any chances of anything standing for fear that's where the snipers would be. And that's, in a lot of instances, that's what happened. The snipers get into the thinking that we would not take down, that's American interest, don't take it down. Well, it's American interest, we're fighting their war, let them build some more. We're not going to take a chance and leave that standing and they come around and get us in our backs. Take them down now.
Did that make you unpopular with the civilians because of the destruction?
No, because the after we were able to, even though we were told that we were not to fraternize with the Germans, that that they were the Gestapo race, and all this race stuff, like they told the English people about the black man, they're telling us about the Germans, putting us, making us hate the Germans. We found that to hate the Germans is to hate the guy that's next to me that's a German. And, gee golly, he's my buddy. I'm not going to hate the Germans, you know?
When did you go into Germany, you know, over the Rhine? Were you...
That was... that would have had to have been in 44.
Yeah, the war ended in May 45, didn't it? So would it have been...
been in 44, the latter part of 44.
What was that like going into Germany? Do you remember the attitude of the Germans?
Well, some of them were very nice. I saw people standing, waving at us, and that kind of a thing. And even though we weren't supposed to talk to them or anything like that, they were actually waving to us. And after the war was over, we found that the government was hiring Germans to in the city, you know, to work in some of the in some capacity as a civilians. But they claimed that they were only trying to get Hitler, but to do all that to get one man, you know, was stupid. Mm-hmm. We found that the Germans were very, very nice people, like any other person, and that America had sold us a big lie, you know, similar to the Granada. So the big lie to the people about that base there.
Did you ever go in or near any of the concentration camps?
No. Not a concentration camp, no.
Did you hear about them, Benny?
I've heard, but I have never been in a concentration camp.
What was your job as you were going through, you know, liberated Europe? What were you in your administrative capacity? What were you doing?
Well, one instance, we were in charge of a what you would call a jail. It was a compound where all of the civilians, not civilians, but army personnel that's been convicted of court-martial would go here for either to be, if his sentence was to be hung by the neck till dead, he would stay there and until his sentencing date, you know, or some, in some instances, they were to come back to the United States and all that kind of stuff.
Were many hung?
Yes, there were quite a few hung. To be hung, the orders would come to me about the individual, and it would always say to be hung, to be hung by the neck till dead, by command of General Bradley or somebody like that.
What would you say the proportion of Afro-Americans would have been of those in prison compared with the white people? Would you say there were more?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I have never read an order of a white soldier to be hung by the neck till dead. Never read an order regarding a white soldier. And most of the fellows in the guardhouse were black. I remember several white officers being in the guardhouse. They were in there for black market. The blacks were in the guardhouse for AWL, for rape, that's the charge, for insubordination. See, sometimes they get to the point, the cracking point, they can only take it so long, they blow up. And that's what they want to happen. Then they get them, gotcha, insubordination. Yeah.
The frontline Afro troops, Benny, what was their performance like? You know, were medals given to Afro-Americans?
Well,
or, you know, were there acts of valor that
yes,
you heard of?
Yes. Let me tell you something. If it hadn't been for the Negro troops, General Patton would have lost the war. And a part of his troops was the formation of the Red Ball Express. The Red Ball Express was an all-black unit. Now, prior to the inception of the Red Ball Express, they had a quartermaster outfit, which was all white, part of that frontline duty. And what they were doing, they were afraid. They were chicken. Some of them were selling the gasoline and filling the tanks up and leaving a tank of water instead of a tank of gasoline and all that kind of stuff. And they were just afraid. They were just, I don't know whether they had battle fatigue or what. They were just afraid. And killing them out and all that kind of stuff. And that's when Patton wanted some seasoned men. People that's mad. See, most of the black soldiers were mad. They were angry because of the treatment. They were angry because of what they had seen. They wanted to get home. They wanted to get out of there. So when he asked for volunteers, let's get this over, let's go. People were tearing their stripes off and everything, running, let's go. Let's get it over with. They were angry. And Patton comes out with his two pearl pistols, makes his speech. We are soldiers. We are soldiers. He accepted the first time that a general of his stature would come out and meet the troops and address the troops.
And was that important, the Red Ball Express? You know, did it do a good job?
Yes, yes. Because without the supply, see, Patton was starving. See, without the supplies, he would be stopped. See, he had a thing going on. And in order for him to keep that going on is to have adequate supplies, such as the gasoline for those tanks, food, ammunition, all of that goes with him. See? And he, as fast as he's moving, you had to really run to keep up with him. And see, what made the Red Ball Express famous was the way they would shoot their way to the front line, delivering the people. See, they had a machine gun mounted on top of the cab, and it was always two to the truck driver and the gunsman shooting his way up into it. When the Red Ball Express would come through a town, they had they painted this the symbol of a red ball on the just above the radiator in front of the truck. And the lead Jeep had a red ball. When the MP directing traffic saw the red ball, that is going to be cleared. No traffic had to stop. Now, in Webster Grove, they would stop the traffic to let the red ball through. Like when President Clinton came to St. Louis, they tied up all the traffic for him to get through. But now that's because people don't know how to drive.
But the Red Ball Express, again, the traffic was stopped for that, wasn't it?
No, you didn't have to. They knew how to drive. Those guys knew how to drive. They were good.
Did you see them yourself?
I saw them. The MP, one of the MPs, Harry Rogers, he's dead now. Harry Rogers was an MP. He broke his Jeep down, the front of the Jeep, the windshield, broke it down, you know, where he could stand on top, right in the center of the intersection. And he could weave the traffic, whereas nobody would have to stop. It was precision, timing. Those trucks would say you had about 30 or 40 trucks in a convoy. None of them would have to stop. Nobody had to stop because, let's face it, all Army vehicles were emergencies. So they couldn't afford to stop one for the other. So you had to figure out a way that you could move all of that traffic without stopping any portion of it. And they had it. Very precision.
Do you think they've... did they get the recognition they deserved, Red Ball Express?
No. They would have gotten it had Patton lived. Had Patton lived, he would have told him. He would have given it to him. He would have told all about what happened. Had Patton lived, there wouldn't have probably been Ike as president.
You obviously admired Patton.
Yes. He was a soldier.
Did you ever see him?
Yes.
What did he look like?
He looked like he was the idealistic soldier. Clean cut, two pearl pistols, one on each side, and he had most of the officers of his rank had white chauffeurs. God forbid, Patton had a black chauffeur.
you tell me now, Benny, about the end of the war and how you celebrated it? The day when, you know, war ended in Europe.
When the war ended in Europe, let me see, what did I do? Where was I? That's when I went to Biarritz. And I recall how beautiful it was. That was the most beautiful. You're talking about paradise. That was so beautiful. Have you ever been there? Oh, it's beautiful. They named the university after the town of Biarritz. And I was told that was a vacation place where kings and the queens would come to play and all of that. And it was a beautiful, beautiful country.
Was this when you went to university?
Could
you tell me the story of how you got to university? I know you went to Oxford as
That was
so
before.
Perhaps we could have this story of Oxford and Biarritz.
Now, Biarritz was different altogether.
Yeah.
Biarritz, the war was over, and instead of coming home right away, you signed a waiver to go to school. So
you went there before Oxford, did you?
No.
No, well, could you put it in order for me,
Oxford Benny? Was first.
Yes, well, could you tell me about that first of all, please?
Oxford.
How you got to Oxford.
I got to Oxford because there was a memo that was handed down to you could select Oxford, I think, and Eden, and there were Cambridge for various courses. And so as the order, as I read it, I filled the paper out, and I had the, as I said, I ran the outfit, and I signed the commander's name to it because I had the authority to sign his name with my initials. He never signed it. He would have known. He would have understood it had he read it. So, I signed and went to Oxford for two weeks.
So you signed yourself into Oxford?
Sure. He's the same person that wouldn't even sign for me to go to school.
He wouldn't have done that?
No.
You'd worked with him some time, hadn't you?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When I started working with him, he was a second lieutenant. And here, because of the administration, man earned captain bars. Now, those bars should have been mine, because he didn't do nothing. Didn't do anything but have fun, have a party. And we're the ones who are working. I'm running the outfit.
What was his name?
Captain Duff.
D-U-F-F.
D-U-F-F. Huh? Oh, I see.
How did you get to Oxford then? What was the procedure once you had signed
up? I cut orders to send to headquarters, which headquarters then would duplicate and send back authorizing me. See, when it comes from headquarters, nothing he can do. Authorizing me to proceed to Oxford University for 2 weeks transportation it provided for and per diem, and all of that was in the orders that I had to take with me to Oxford University.